I think I said at the end of class yesterday that I would do a little bit of wrap-up just to kind of clarify what we were saying about industry custom. And again, the point of it is to recognize that, yes, how things are done in the industry will be the kind of evidence that a jury would find persuasive. If you can establish that the defendant was within the custom of the industry, doing what everybody else is doing, as Learned Hand said, reasonable prudence is often common prudence. But then he goes on to say, but strictly speaking, it is never its measure, meaning that you can't assume that because someone conforms to the standard of the industry, or for that matter, because they don't conform to the standard of the industry, that by itself establishes negligence. So the jury is free, according to Learned Hand, and the courts that follow him, which are legion, as we will see, the jury can say, in effect, the custom of the industry doesn't meet our standard, and the courts will allow the jury to make that judgment. Any questions about that little area? Okay, now we move on to look at another tool that the plaintiff may turn to establish that the defendant was negligent, namely that the defendant violated some statute, and that violation was negligent. And to figure out exactly what the legal effect is of a statutory violation, we look at these next cases. As I said before, like the Bennett-Cooper pairing, we have this Martin versus Herzog pairing with Tedler versus Ellman, and part of your assignment here is to figure out what is exactly the relationship. So to tell us about Martin versus Herzog, Mr. Collier, why don't you tell us about Martin versus Herzog? Are we there? Oh. It's not in your list there? But then let me come back to you on that one. It's better if you actually got a brief in hand that you can refer to. Ms. Medley, can you tell us about Martin versus Herzog? Okay, let's slow down there for a second. So we have the trial of the case, plaintiff saying this guy was negligent. Defendant says, well, maybe so, but even if I was negligent, the plaintiff was also negligent, and the effect of that in this period of time would be what? If the jury found the plaintiff was also negligent, what legal effect would such a finding have? Right, the plaintiff would be barred from recovery. Okay, so a lot hinges on the jury's determination of that issue. Okay, so at the trial of the case, you started to tell me what happened. Okay, and the defendant, having lost, now appeals. What's the basis of the defendant's appeal? Yeah, And again, a classic form, figuring out how to identify the burden of proof or what's at issue. Some cases there's a directed verdict or there's a jury verdict that someone says should have been overturned by a JNOV. In this case, what we have is a complaint about the accuracy of the instruction given to the jury. So first of all, let's identify what instruction was given to the jury and then figure out what's wrong with that according to the defendant. The instruction that was given to the jury was? Okay, so the jury was permitted to use the statutory violation as evidence of negligence. What's wrong with that from the defendant's standpoint? Tell me again, what's wrong with that? Why would the defendant be unhappy with that instruction? Actually, he's not contesting their finding that he was negligent. It lay within the jury's province to find him negligent, but he still doesn't like that instruction. Again, what's wrong with it? Well, they could. They were given the opportunity to be found at fault. So what's his beef? Yes, ma'am. So what the defendant wants is what? Right. The defendant's complaint is this trial instruction is way too wimpy. Yeah, we can do this. Yeah. He wants the trial judge to grab the jury by the scruff of the neck, stick the judge's finger in their face and say, are you listening? This is what you're going to do. You're going to find these people negligent. You got that? So, and I'm not saying that to you. It's the trial judge who's supposed to be obnoxious, not the professor here. So, but that's what the defendant wants. And he claims, he argues to the appellate court that he's entitled to that. What does Cardozo and his pals say? It should be charged as a matter of law. Again, what we're talking about here, again, figuring out what's our burden of proof or what is it people are they asking for their day in court, or are they asking for something much more muscular here, which is, in effect, I don't want the plaintiff to have their day in court. I want the plaintiff's hash to be settled by the judge as a matter of law. Now, how could Cardozo reach that conclusion? What's the basis for saying the jury should be given no choice about this, but should be directed that this was a negligent act? What's the reason behind that? Okay. And to allow the jury, in effect, to say, well, yeah, you violated the law, but we don't really think that's negligent. According to Cardozo, this would essentially be, it's as though you said to the jury, well, you really don't have to listen to this hearsay, but if you want to, go ahead. You know, here's the measure of damages, but if you don't like that measure of damages, substitute your own. Here's the definition of negligence, but if you don't like that definition of negligence, use your own. Wait a minute, that would be total chaos. The law is the law, according to Cardozo, and the jury is not free to set the law aside and do something different. This is Cardozo's, what sort of this kind, almost caricature of this kind of hard-nosed, inflexible character here. And of course, we've seen Cardozo before. We'll see him again. He's not an unfamiliar character to us. Okay, so if we understand what Cardozo is saying about the finding of negligence, that it's not an option for the jury, it is required of the jury, what's the effect, according to Cardozo? Where do we go procedurally from there? If the jury was improperly instructed on this point and should have been told that the plaintiff was negligent as a matter of law, now how do we go on from here in terms of the outcome of this case? You see my eye curl up there. And in skepticism here, there's actually something else that we need to at least think about. Now, it turns out that Cardozo pulls the plug on this case and it's over, but before he does that, he goes through another at least logical step. What's the second logical step that he feels he needs to go through? He says it's negligence as a matter of law. You go ahead. Yes, he does. And this is a big deal here, just again seeing the big picture. We're stuck in chapter one trying to figure out how do we make a determination about whether somebody can be found to have breached a duty, to be at fault or strictly liable or whatever theory is being advanced. But there's chapter two that stands on its own, in effect, which says even if you can show that somebody was negligent, you've got to show that negligence proximately caused the injury. And normally, this case is a little bit confusing because we've flipped things around and now we're looking to the plaintiff's negligence. Normally, we're looking to the defendant's negligence, but these are such wonderful cases for analytical purposes that I'm willing to put you through this little transposition. But Cardozo recognizes that even if the plaintiff were negligent, as a matter of law, it wouldn't bar the plaintiff's case unless that negligence proximately caused the injury. What does he say about that issue? What do we know about the issue of proximate cause in this case? First of all, what's the evidence? And let's just kind of set ourselves in context. You got the defendant going around the corner too fast. He's going so fast that he can't stay in his lane. He drifts over into the plaintiff's lane. His claim is that the lack of light on the buggy prevented him from avoiding the collision, that if only the plaintiff had had a light, the defendant would have been able to stop in time. Therefore, it's at least partially because of the plaintiff's negligence that this accident happened. What's the plaintiff's argument? Remember, the defendant at this point is not contesting the finding of negligence on his part. He's not saying that I was done wrong because they found that I was negligent. The defendant's complaint is, even if I am negligent, the plaintiff still can't recover. So does the plaintiff no good to say, yeah, but the defendant was negligent? The plaintiff somehow has to show there is no causal connection, as you rightly pointed out, between the lack of light on the buggy and the collision. Why wouldn't there be a connection between those two? Yes, ma'am. There's a full moon. You know, relative to a full moon, what, you know, candle power is on this buggy? And, you know, maybe we would do some kind of accident reconstruction here to figure out under a full moon with the measly light coming out of this, how much stopping time would that add to this? Who says the defendant was even paying attention such that a light would have made any difference? Now, remember, in terms of the burden of proof here, in terms of who has to prove what in order to win, the plaintiff is simply asking for another trial. Even if the jury is instructed that as a matter of law, the plaintiff was negligent, shouldn't the jury be at liberty to look at the facts and say, maybe it caused it, maybe it didn't? We can't find against the plaintiff unless we can say, as a matter of law, no reasonable person could reach any conclusion except that this lack of light caused the accident. Is Cardozo willing to go that far? If he goes that far, he dismisses the plaintiff's claim. If he doesn't go that far, he says, wrong jury instruction, go back, retry this case, give the plaintiff a chance to argue the causation issue. Yeah, he pulls the trigger, says you're dead, in effect. Pulls the plug, whatever the metaphor is. It's over for Cardozo. Now, again, Cardozo seems to be a little bit high-handed here in terms of taking from the jury what would seem a question about which reasonable minds could differ. That on these facts, it seems hard to say as a matter of law the plaintiff's lack of light caused the accident. But again, as we'll see, Cardozo's not entirely, I don't want to become too sociological here, but Cardozo seems to be white knuckle time here, afraid of what the jury's going to do. They've already demonstrated their willingness to set the law aside to find that this plaintiff wasn't negligent. If we go back and essentially tell them, you blew it, folks, these people are negligent as a matter of law. It wouldn't be the same jury, but it sort of illustrates to Cardozo how unreliable juries are. Perhaps in his mind he's thinking, I can't trust the jury to make an honest call about whether causation should be found. They're going to take pity on these poor plaintiffs and give them a verdict, despite the fact that the evidence favors a finding of causation. So again, you can look at this and say, I don't understand. I do understand Cardozo's position. Maybe I agree with it, maybe I don't. But I understand his position with respect to what the judge is required to do faced with a statutory violation. What I don't understand is why he made this determination about causation when it appears it ought to be a question for the jury. But we'll leave that somewhat unresolved in order to move on to the second of our pairing here, Tedler versus Allman. It's the same court, some of the same personnel. It's 19 years later. Actually, I don't even know if it is the same personnel, if anybody's left over who was on the court 19 years earlier, but they sure feel a sense of continuity that it's not that they can blow off Martin versus Herzog and pretend it never existed. Mr. Collier, how about that one? Good. Okay. Now again, contributory negligence is this. It's not a linguistic or linguistically accurate term to simply say negligence that contributed to the accident. Contributory negligence is taken as a phrase to mean the plaintiff's negligence. So, and again, the legal effect of it in this era was not to say, well, it reduces the plaintiff's recovery proportionately, so forth and so on. Contributory negligence is the end of the line. Now, again, the defendant is saying, well, maybe I was negligent, but the plaintiff was supposed to be over here, walking, facing the traffic. And therefore, it was the plaintiff's violation of the statute, negligent as a matter of law, that caused this accident, and therefore I shouldn't have to pay. So the defendant's case on appeal is based completely, or at least primarily, upon Martin versus Herzog. Defendant's going to say, just as in Martin versus Herzog, the court must find that the plaintiff's negligence caused this accident, and therefore I'm relieved of any liability. If you're the plaintiff's lawyer in Tedler versus Ellman, how do you avoid Martin versus Herzog running over you like a 18-wheeler? How do you keep Martin versus Herzog from being the case that essentially can be written on this case's epitaph here? You have to distinguish it, okay? And in particular, you have to say that the rule announced in Martin versus Herzog doesn't apply here. What's the rule that Cardozo announces in Martin versus Herzog? Mr. Breck? Close. There's one word, keyword that's, what's that? No, actually, that's the, you're right about Cardozo says there's no maybe about it. It is negligence in itself. What's that? Okay, but there's a word you left out in your description. That, a person can do it inadvertently, still, Mr. Wright? Let's go back to the text here, the sacred text. Martin versus Herzog, right-hand column, page 25. We, the royal we the court, think, what's the word? Unexcused, the key word here that distinguishes the case. To say even Mr. Hardcore Inflexible Cardozo recognizes that this doctrine doesn't apply where the violation is excused. Who decides whether the violation is excused? The jury. So to the extent that the plaintiff is trying to work his way back home here, to be back in the arms of the jury again, doesn't want to face Cardozo in his role as judge, you know, executing stragglers, the plaintiff only has to prove I have an excuse which gets me to the jury. And the jury then decides whether under the circumstances my choice of violating the statute was reasonable or not. What's the plaintiff's excuse for walking on that side of the road? Okay, and the more general principle under which that excuse would fall is what? Give me the sort of general principle of which this is a concrete example. You're not under a duty to you're not under a duty to obey a statute when well, that sort of begs the question. I mean, that's but you're I think you were groping for it earlier, the idea that you're doing what by violating the statute? You're acting, this is the sort of, I'm fulfilling the spirit of the law even while I'm violating the letter of the law. So if the purpose of the law is to make it safer for me to, I'm supposed to be on the side of the street which promotes safety, sort of to generalize about the rule, then sure, the letter of the law says walk on the side facing traffic, but let's look at the purpose of the law. It's supposed to put me on the side of the street that will make it less likely that I will be hit. And usually that's facing traffic, but under these circumstances, going with traffic was safer because there was such heavy traffic coming the other way and very light traffic coming this way. Does the court buy that? Yeah, they say this is a question for the jury. Unlike Martin versus Herzog, where the judge appropriately, what the judge should have done, was in effect to hold a gun to the jury's head, or grab them by the scruff of the neck, and tell them what to do. Here it was appropriate, says the court, for the trial judge to present the case to the jury for their consideration. Do you think under these circumstances the plaintiffs acted reasonably by walking on this side of the street rather than the other? If you do, you may excuse them, in effect. Mr. Harris. Now, when we get to the notes someplace here that actually list some of the excuses recognized, it's over in page 29, where you have a list on the right-hand column here from the restatement, section 288A, excused violations. It actually goes through a number of different scenarios in which the restatement recognizes these kinds of excuses. So one would be, like this one, compliance would involve a greater risk of harm to the actor or to others. But there are other excuses. The guy in the buggy, for example, might have started out with a lamp that was lit, but the bulb, I guess he wouldn't have a bulb, it would be some, you know, gasoline, or not gasoline, it would be like a kerosene lamp or whatever it was. Again, making us skeptical about the value of this in under a full moon. But if the actor, the violation is reasonable because of the actor's incapacity, in other words, the thing burns out, I can't do anything about it because they don't have any more kerosene, or I didn't know a falling tree knocked it out, or there's some other reason why I couldn't comply with the statute, that would offer an excuse. Now, we're not there yet, but in the next case, we talk about the range of excuses that are potentially exonerating as compared to the kinds of excuses that don't exonerate. But again, the distinction the court adopts in Tedla versus Ellman is to say, well, in Martin versus Herzog, they really didn't have an excuse. They weren't there claiming, well, we had a light, but it got knocked out by a falling tree, or somebody stole it, or, you know, it was an emergency and I had to get my wife to the doctor, or some other reason why they would be excused from carrying a light on their buggy. On the facts of this, I think one could be skeptical of the applicability of the excuse. Why do you think it might actually be more dangerous for these people to be walking on this side of the road rather than that side of the road? Even if the traffic is heavy coming this way and light going that way. They can't see, and why is that for them particularly problematic? Ms. Haynes? At least one of these, one of the plaintiffs can't hear. Therefore, the sound, for example, of an oncoming car, one that's on the gravel, you know, coming off the pavement, would be one he would be unable to anticipate. Whereas if he at least has the advantage of seeing them as they come along, somebody who's distracted or falls asleep and drifts off the highway, they'd have a chance to jump away from. Moreover, it's not clear that they were excused for walking on the wrong side of the street. If, in fact, it was dangerous, was there another route they could take, for example? Could they have waited until after this heavy traffic had passed by? Is there some other way they could have complied with the statute and fulfilled the interest in safety? So just as the guy with the buggy, if he runs out of kerosene and can't fill his light, that doesn't give him an excuse for setting out with no light. At least I wouldn't think it would. Again, the trial judge is put in the awkward position of saying, is this an issue about which the jury gets to decide whether it's excused or not? Do I let go of this and give it to the jury? Or do I hear Cardozo's voice in my ear telling me as a trial judge that it's wrong for me to allow, in effect, the jury to dispense with a requirement made by the legislature? Somewhere along the line, I've got to figure out which things qualify as an excused violation and which things don't. Now, there's another feature, I just want to mention it, at the risk of confusing you. If you find this confusing, just set it aside and we'll pick it up on another day. But I want to sort of touch base with something that we come to in Chapter 2. At the end of the opinion, the court offers, in effect, an alternative holding, an alternative way to reach the same conclusion. And that is to say that even if the plaintiffs acted negligently, their negligence didn't cause the accident. And it's potentially confusing because we haven't started talking about causation yet, and this is a fairly complex version of the causation issue. But the court distinguishes between the sort of philosophical here. At the very bottom of page 28, they say you have to distinguish between an efficient cause and a necessary condition or attendant cause. And again, this is something we'll pick up again in Chapter 2, the idea that when you speak of something being a cause, part of what you mean is, well, if it weren't for this thing, the accident wouldn't have happened. It was an attendant cause or a necessary condition. So if I pack up my books and leave the classroom, get out to my car to go run an errand and realize, oops, I left my cell phone behind, and I come back into the building, re-enter the classroom, pick up my cell phone, put it back in my pocket, get out to my car 5 minutes after my original schedule, you know, when I would have left had I not forgotten my cell phone. I then get on the highway and I'm struck by some out-of-control cement truck. Were it not for forgetting my cell phone, I would have been past that point to my destination, never would have encountered that cement truck. Forgetting my cell phone caused being hit by a cement truck. Caused in what sense? Caused in the sense that if it weren't for this, I wouldn't have been at that precise location. But the court is saying, wait a minute, legal or proximate cause is more than just an attendant condition. It's what the court calls an efficient cause. It actually does work. It moves the action in the direction we're talking about. does forgetting my cell phone make it more likely I'm going to be hit by a cement truck? No. It's a pure coincidence. And in that respect, the court is saying the fact that they were here rather than here was a necessary condition. If it weren't for the choice to walk on this side of the street rather than the other, but it's not an efficient condition in the sense that it made it more likely. They were actually more likely to be hit over on this side of the street than they were if they're walking over here. So at least the court is thinking, or believes the jury might have properly been thinking. And again, if you find this horribly confusing, just drop it, and we'll talk about it later on when we get to chapter 2. But to the extent that you saw that and wondered, well, what's that all about, I thought I might simply clarify. Okay, so again, the issue in the case is what's the effect of a statutory violation, and at least at this point, everybody is agreed that an unexcused statutory violation yields a finding of negligence per se, in itself, as a matter of law. Not woulda, coulda, shoulda. If the jury's in the mood, it's negligence, period. Now, obviously, that leaves the issue about whether something can be excused as a debatable point. And in Nettleton versus Thompson, we see a case in which the court thought it was an excusing condition, but the appellate court wants to reconsider that. So why don't we take up a Nettleton versus Thompson? We may or may not be able to turn the corner on this, but at least we'll get it started. Ms. Reynolds, can you tell us about Nettleton? Yeah. Okay. There are actually two different things that the plaintiff complains about these stairs. One is that it doesn't have a handrail. The other complaint is that the tread was too narrow, that one of the things you have is a building code requirement is that the stairs be, obviously the wider the stairs, the more gradual the descent, the more narrow the stairs, the more it looks like a ladder. So this was closer to the ladder side of the spectrum than it was to the, gradually sloping height. Okay, so according to the plaintiff, on both these grounds, there was a violation of the statute, and the plaintiff says, and that's what the defendant says, but the plaintiff says that the effect of this violation of the statute is, yes, negligence as a matter of law. Again, not, hey, why don't you roll this around and see if you find this to be negligent. The plaintiff says, trial judge, you have no choice except to make a finding as a matter of law, tell the jury in no uncertain terms that the defendant was negligent. Okay, and the defendant's response to that is what? Okay, and what's the significance of that? Okay, so their pitch is that, I don't walk around with the uniform building code memorized. It was news to us that this particular feature was out of compliance. Moreover, says the defendant, yeah. We in effect got the blessing of the tax assessor who looked at our property and saw no problem. So if it's good enough for him, why should we be on the hook for failing to recognize this? What does the trial judge do? Okay, and whom does that favor? Yeah, because he's given the defendant some wiggle room. And what does the jury do with that wiggle room? Okay, and they find for the defendant. So the defendant dodges the bullet of negligence. The jury finds no negligence, and the plaintiff loses. Now, it's the plaintiff who's complaining about this, taking it up to the Idaho Supreme Court here. And what's the plaintiff's argument on appeal? Okay. And when we go back to this list of excuses, back in the on page 29 here, what does it most closely, which of these does it seem to fall into? If you're the defendant, which of the subcategories under number 2 would you make your pitch for? Okay. And does that fit these facts? According to the defendant, it does. What's the plaintiff's argument in response to that? Why does this not fit the category? But if they don't know the stairs are out of compliance, how can they fairly be blamed for that? Mr. Starnes? All well and good, but hey, I'm just a homeowner. I don't know nothing about no UBC. And well, you know, if the jury thinks I'm an idiot because I don't know the UBC, fine. Tell me my violation is unexcused. But shouldn't I at least be able to go to the jury and ask them whether they think my failure to know this was excusable? I'm sorry, I can't see your name. Ms. Williams, yeah. This shows you what a warped childhood I had, but one of the expressions I remember from my childhood is, ignorance of the law is no excuse. And it turns out to be a legal principle, and it's of some interest in criminal law. I assume at some point you spend a fair amount of time actually pondering the effect, which is much more dramatic in a criminal context. It's one thing if you take away my property. It's another thing if you throw me in jail because I violated some law of which I was ignorant. And it turns out it doesn't matter that my ignorance was reasonable, that I didn't know that page 482 of the Federal Regulatory Code of Hazardous Waste classifies this chemical as being whatever it was. It doesn't even matter that I went to some lawyer and asked, do you think that I'm in compliance with this? And the lawyer tells me yes. Ignorance of the law is no excuse. So says the tradition of the criminal law. And there are a variety of different reasons for that, some different, but it turns out to be something that about which there's general agreement. No one's really proposing, except in very limited circumstances, that ignorance of the law would ever form an excuse, even to a criminal charge, much less to something where there's a civil liability at stake. So the court, in effect, draws the line to say what this previous commentary about excused violations, when they talk about that the actor was unaware of the occasion for compliance, that's ignorance of the facts, the occasion for compliance. If, for example, I own a house and they take the railing down because they're repainting the wall, and I am unaware of the fact that after taking the railing down and painting it, they didn't put the railing back, and somebody falls down the stairs, I can plead ignorance. Gee, I didn't know the railing was down. That will excuse me. If I don't know the taillight is out on my car and an accident happens, that will excuse me. But I can never base an excuse upon ignorance of the law. Now, again, the philosophical reasons for that, you'll spend more time in criminal law, having to do with, there's one philosophical tradition that says, in effect, the law is not arbitrary. The law is simply the expression of things which are, in effect, written on the human heart. And therefore, you don't need a statute to tell you what's right or wrong. You know it intuitively. That's one argument. The other argument is that the law is something where we don't want to reward people for being ignorant, that the people who seek out greater knowledge of the law are treated worse than the people who never bother to find anything out. There are all sorts of rationalizations of why we've come to this position, but come to this position we have. So again, what the court winds up doing is to say, in a more general sense, you can't be excused unless there's an objectively reasonable excuse. You can't simply say the dog ate my homework or I was having a bad day. The excuse has to be one that is objectively reasonable. And the court says ignorance never fits into that category. And in more specific terms, the court's not going to adopt a view that says ignorance of the law is an excuse. In any event, we wind up at that point. Let me just say we'll start tomorrow with these questions at the end of the Nettleton case on page 32, just to sort of review what is it that we've learned about negligence per se, and how do these rules fit a larger pattern. So we'll pick up there.